Yeah, 2007. We have a number of bills set today, and let me give you an indication of what's going to happen. We're going to, I'll announce now that we will not be going to work session on Senate Bill 1042A and Senate Bill 248A. Those bills will be rolled over until tomorrow's meeting. And we'll be going, and then among the bills that are on the agenda, remaining bills, we'll be going first to the public hearing and possible work session for purposes of moving to rules, and then we'll be going to Senate Bill 345, then 279, then 406, and then see where we are at that point. So I'm going to begin by opening a hearing on Senate Bill 473. Now let me announce here, I see we have a couple of people who are signed up on 473. We had attempted to alert in the notice here that the bill is being heard for the purpose of referring it to the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. So it was not our intention to work to deal with the substance of the bill. It is late in the session, and it's to keep this bill alive so that it will be in the possession of another committee that's open longer. I see I have a couple of people who've signed up, and I'm not going to have counsel describe this content of the bill because that's not what the purpose of our consideration today. But I do have Dana Bauer and Paul Stiegleiter. I apologize if you made a special trip in order to present on the substance of the bill. Are those witnesses here? Is it because of interest in the bill as it was introduced that you're here today? We're not going to be considering the substance of the bill. It was set to in order to be able to move it to another committee. So I would urge you to then weigh in with that other committee, with the Ethics, Elections, and Rules Committee. Apologize for your having made a trip here to present. Yes, it stays alive, but we don't have the time to be able to consider the substance of the bill here in this committee. So once if and when it's brought to a hearing then in the Rules Committee, then that would be the time to present on it. And I apologize again for that confusion. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 473 and open a work session on Senate Bill 473. And would invite a motion to move the bill without recommendation to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules.
So made.
Representative Krieger moves that Senate Bill 473 be moved without recommendation to the Committee on Ethics, Elections, Ethics, and Rules. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Excuse
me.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Commissioner Wisnett?
Aye.
Chairman
Person? Aye. Senate Bill 473 moves without recommendation to the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 473 and open a work session on Senate Bill 345A. Council Kelmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 345A is a bill that this committee has heard about maybe I think a few times, which concerns the duties of a judgment creditor at a sale of foreclosure to inform the bidders of other liens or interests on the property. And there are two amendments before the committee. One is the A5s and also the A6s. The A5s, I believe, are were drafted at the request of the bar. And I'll let David Niebel describe what they do. The A6s were drafted by this committee, and what the A6s say is that at least 10 days before the date first set for execution sale, so one thing to point out is that it keys off the initial date of the sale. We heard some testimony about how these sales get pushed back a few times, so the duty of a creditor would only apply to that first date. And what the creditor would have to provide the sheriff is any report for real property to be sold at the execution sale that is in the possession of the judgment creditor, and that shows interest of record in the property. So what this means is to the extent that the judgment creditor has one of those reports, and there was some testimony that says that most of these creditors get reports as a matter of course, they would have to provide a copy to the bidders, or at least to the sheriff, and the sheriff would provide it to the bidders. Another part of the A6s states that no civil action may be brought against the title company, the judgment creditor, the sheriff, or any other person by reason of omissions or errors in the report, and the validity of the sale is not affected by reason of any omissions or errors in the report. So what that means is that no liability would flow to anybody based on that report. So it would just be a situation where the judgment creditor, if they have a report, would be required to turn it over to the sheriff. The sheriff would provide copies to the bidders, and that would provide some notice of other liens and interests in the property without any using that as an ability to set aside the sale in the future. So it would preserve some due diligence requirement. And the A5 amendments, David, did you want to talk about those?
In fact, what should we have Senator Brzozinski and Mr. Nebel come forward, and, because they so they'd be available to discuss the issues in each one of these amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Nebel with the Oregon State Bar. As counsel said, the A5 amendments are proposed by the bar to, and what they do basically is they would require the insertion in a notice of sale of a notice to prospective buyers that they're under a duty to do an independent investigation about any liens or any problems or any regulatory matters involving the property, so that they would be under a duty to protect themselves, basically, and to do their own investigation. That's the approach that the debtor-creditor section of the bar favors, and that's what these amendments would do.
Senator Brzozinski, did you want to make comments on one or both of the sets of amendments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Floyd Brzozinski, State Senator, District 4. This is great. Both of these amendments actually will accomplish what 345 actually set forth. If you remember, the first bill, actually, the original bill had a requirement that some type of notice be given in the paper regarding whatever information the individual lien holder had regarding any other liens that are there, and then also at the time of the sale that some type of documentation be provided if a bidder requests it to be able to look at it. So I think the A5 and A6s work hand in hand and should be both adopted by the committee. I do want to point out on the A6, and I want to thank counsel for his work in coming forward and bringing what you have before you, because I think it's real important, as he said in his delivery as to what this actually will provide. It addresses many of the concerns that we heard from the State Bar as to what they want to make sure their clients weren't going to be required to do at an additional expense. First of all, it's keyed on the first date of that's set for the execution sale. So whatever documentation they have, if they have any documentation, so they don't have to go out and buy anything, but if they have it, then they need to make it available, so long as it meets the criteria showing who has any other interest in that property. And most, probably just as important, if not more important, is the lines 10 through 14 that basically takes away any right of civil action by a person who looks at those reports and then wants to somehow come back against some type of omission or error that was in that report. So this is the best of all worlds in the sense of it's going to give notice under the A5s for anyone that's looking through the newspaper as to what their duty is, and they have a responsibility as a potential bidder. And the A6, if there is, in fact, some document that's been created at the request of the lien holder, who is the creditor who wants to be selling that property, that it or he or she will have a duty to provide a copy of it when the first setting for the execution sale is set, and it gives the protection that there's no liability that flows from that document to the bidder who looks at it.
Mr. Nebel, did you have any comments on the substance of the A6s, which is this requirement of turning over anything you have without the judgment creditor has to turn over anything they have in their possession, but with no liability attaching as a result of the information contained therein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the people in the debtor-creditor section are satisfied with this about not as not creating any further liability for them. I was able to distribute this late yesterday afternoon to members of the section, and Mr. Bell, who appeared before the committee last week, sent an email this morning that said that basically that was fine, but it was unclear that it was really going to provide the information that was needed, because apparently, and I'm way out of my element here, but it's apparently foreclosure guarantees, which is the document that the seller is most likely to have, don't include senior liens. They include liens and interests junior to the interest that's being foreclosed, but not interests that are senior or above, or that would take precedence above the interest that's being foreclosed. So to the extent that the person is going to rely on this report, it may be that they're relying on information that's given in completely in good faith by the judgment creditor, but still may be incomplete.
Wouldn't it be important for them, even if it's incomplete, to know what the junior liens are? If they're thinking of buying the property, they have as much information as they can get about obligations against the property.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's fine. But I think that the notice to the that's included in the A5 amendments would probably be an important thing to put in to this bill as well, creating the duty of due diligence to investigate the property on the part of the buyer.
Any questions? Person Krieger.
What happens if this judgment creditor doesn't provide it? He knows about it, but he doesn't provide it. He says he must provide it, but what is the ramifications for his failure to do that?
Well,
that's kind of like it was at the sale, where when the guy asked the question,
yeah,
are there any judgments, and they never answered the question, and they went right on. So if there's no penalty for him not providing it, and he didn't want to because it was a judgment, I don't see where it fixes that situation.
Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Representative Krieger. My thought was, what would happen if someone had the information but didn't provide it is that the sale would be delayed. So the sale wouldn't go forward. So I mean, there's sort of two different ways to go about it. If they do it on purpose, if they have information and the sheriff says, where's the information, and they say, oh, we don't have any, but they actually do, if that's what you're concerned about, I don't know if, under this, it says that you couldn't set aside because of any omissions in the report, but it doesn't say you can't set it aside for failing to provide information that you know about. So it's somewhat ambiguous as to what would happen, but I don't think that situation is expressly covered by these amendments. It only says that if you hand over the report and there's something that's not in the report that, you know, was omitted by somebody, that's not a reason to set aside the foreclosure. But it doesn't say if you fail to provide a report, even though you have one, that some liability might not flow from that. So, but I would say it's ambiguous. So,
Mr. Chair. If they intentionally omitted certain things by reason of omissions or errors down in line 12, but if it was intentional for the purpose of defrauding, something's got to be here to take care of that. I don't know.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, what I would say is, going back to your first question, I think that this would set up basically a failure to disclose, and that failure to disclose could be actionable since it does say that it must be provided to the sheriff. So if someone actually had the reports in their possession and they failed to disclose it, I believe there could be a civil action. Now, clearly there's no penalty set up, okay, as we would normally see in, let's say, criminal proceedings or where if you don't do this, this is what you're going to get as a fine. Clearly that's something you could do, but I'm not here asking this committee to do that. I think the records will stay for itself. Regarding the part that's on the errors and omissions and not affecting the sale, that part really, as counsel said, is dealing when there is an omission or error in the report. And so if it's something that's not, if the report's not even given, then I believe that there could, in fact, be some issues there. Now, whether or not someone actually took a report, doctored it up, and then handed it in, I would think that there would be another action that could be there based on fraud.
Or just good faith or something.
Yeah, faith.
Good faith, fair dealing. So.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Council, why in dash 6, you say no civil action can be brought against a title company, a judgment credit, the sheriff, or any other persons. Why? Where did we come up with those specific three people? The gentleman that complained was talking about Bank of America, who I'm assuming is the mortgage company or the mortgage holder.
Yeah, the Bank of America was the judgment creditor in that case. So I think the three people...
That's the second one? Okay.
Right. So it would be the title company would provide the report, the judgment creditor would give the report to the sheriff, and the sheriff would give the report out to the bidder. So I think we're just... I can't remember if I asked legislative council to do that or they just did that. But I think it's just trying to cover all their bases. And then you have the any other person.
So the judgment creditor is the mortgage. Could be the first, second.
Right. It's the person who is who holds the lien on the property that's executing, who's foreclosing on the property.
Okay. Council, I have a question about the mechanics of how these two amendments go to the bill. Can these both be adopted and fit into the bill correctly, or are they... Or they drafted in the alternative?
Thank you, Chairman Pearson. I believe they can both be adopted, and the smart people at Legislative Council can work it out. I think they both can be adopted.
Okay, very good.
How about 4?
Question?
We need to.
To be honest, I don't remember what 4 says.
There was an A4 amendment that was in my bill file from before, a week ago.
Yeah, 4 would conflict. 4 was the original amendment that would have taken everything out except the original idea that you had to provide a title report.
It goes away.
So, yeah, 6 would be an alternative to 4.
Right. So it's the A5s and A6s that are really before us.
I guess one other question, Mr. Chair, is from council is, did the credit people and the title people, did they look at this and they have a...
Thank you, Vice Chair Wisnett. I'd spoken to somebody at Stewart Title, their attorney, about the language in A6. I did not, though, give them the actual amendment. I told them where we were thinking about going, and they seemed that they're not here, but I did not give them this, so they haven't seen it. I just got this morning.
In a conversation I had with the with Craig Chisholm from Stewart Title, who appeared when we heard the bill before, I think I'd be fair to say his preference would be just the A5s, because that wouldn't involve any furnishing of information that had come from a title company, because of his concern being that there might be obligations that would arise out of that. The provision on lines 11 or 10 through 14 of the A6s was drafted in response to that concern. So I don't know that we have confirmation back that that's fine, but this was just specifically put in to protect the title company. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like both the amendments and don't think they're inconsistent, but I have a question about line 7 on the A6. Any report for real property to be sold at the execution sale that's in the possession of the judgment creditor, I would like, at least for the record, to try to figure out if we're talking about something other than, for example, the foreclosure guarantee, because you might have some sort of in-house reports about all the properties you're considering, or I think that could be interpreted very broadly, any report. So I would like to see, at least have a discussion about what's intended by that particular phrase.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson, Representative Matamichi. The intent was to... The difficulty was is there's various instruments out there that people get, and we didn't want to just say title report and then say, well, we didn't get one, we got a foreclosure guarantee. So in speaking with counsel to this title company, they suggested sort of a broad language that just defines a which would cover all of those types of reports. It's not intended to allow a judgment creditor just to make a WordPerfect document that lists things. It's supposed to be a report that they purchased for this purpose, which is to list interest of record in that property and to turn that over. So that is the intent.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then we're ready to act on the A5 and A6 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move A5 into Senate Bill 345.
Representative Parker moves the A5s into Senate Bill 345. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, then the A5s are in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 45. The A6 is in the Senate Bill 345.
And Representative Barker moves the A6 amendments in the Senate Bill 345. Any discussion?
Just a further clarification, Mr. Chair, that the report is intended to mean specifically for that property and not sort of in-house reports that list many different properties. With that clarification.
Yes. And thank you, Representative. And I see that the closing phrase on line 9 is I think modifies the earlier material and says, and that shows interests of record in the property. So it would have to be something that shows liens or other interests that have been recorded. Any further discussion? Any objection to the adoption of the A6 amendments? If not, then the A6s are in the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 345 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 345 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamy. Aye.
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 Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 345 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any volunteer here to carry the bill? Representative Bonamici, thank you very much.
Being allowing yourself to be drafted.
Volunteers.
Okay, then we'll now open a work session on Senate Bill 279. Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 279 comes to you at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on the Judiciary, and you have the dash 6 amendments in front of you, which replace the bill. And basically what they do is they call for a filing fee on motions of $50, and a responding party would have a fee of $35. We give to the Chief Justice which motions would be subject to the fee, those collection of those fees. It states that the fees provided in this section may not be collected from the state, a county, a city, or school district. Also, as chair members of the committee, there are certain motions in which these fees would not be charged, voluntary dismissal for a motion for judgment, written stipulation. Also, that the fees may not be collected for motions made to an arbitrator or mediator. Then in section 4, Mr. Chair members of the committee, it doubles the fee for the setting up the account for the collection of a judgment. And then going over to Section 6, it allows certain fees to be collected by the plaintiff when you have a garnishment or to recover a debt under RS 18854.
And I know this has been worked out through some discussions over funding of the Judicial Department. Are there presenters who would like to offer comment on we're in work session on this bill? Ms. Click, did you want to present?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. And with me is also Jim Markey, from collectors who will present some information as well. The bill does replace the current language of the bill with these amendments. The Dash 6 amendments are the ones that we're recommending for adoption. The amendments would allow fees, to be charged for filing response on motions in what I call the general and purely civil cases in the circuit court. I have passed out some information because as we've talked with people, they wanted to make clear they understood the scope of 21110 and 21010, the motions to which this would apply to. They do not apply to probate, to juvenile, to FEDs, to small claims, to arbitration proceedings, and the like. In fact, the statute itself does exclude other categories as well, and I've listed those. I'm trying not to use all your time to go through what I'm handing out. I did give some examples of typical general civil proceedings, the types of motions that would be likely encompassed by those, including Rule 21 motions. This would apply as well in the appellate court, and that, too, I've provided information on what the limitations are on charging in that arena. As Mr. Taylor said, the installment payment fees, it's something we currently do when payments are going to be made over a long period of time, and the court's responsible for monitoring the timely payments. This would just change the range of the fees in that area from 25 to 50 to 50 to 100. And I'd be happy to go through any particular questions. Mr. Marquis may want to speak to some parts of it as well.
And Ms. Click, is it my understanding then that there is no fee filed for a motion in circuit court practice in Oregon currently? Is that right?
Chairman McPherson, that is correct in the civil area. In domestic relations, there are motions fees, post-judgment motion fees, and those are charged at the amount here, the 50 and 35, but not in general civil. That's correct.
And what is the practice in other states? Are we pioneering in this this situation, or is this something that other trial courts and other states do?
Chair McPherson, I'm not familiar with all 50 states. I know on the West Coast that California does charge. Not sure that, so we're not a pioneer on the West Coast. I do not believe that Washington State or Idaho charge.
Okay. Any questions? Why don't we hear from Mr. Marquis, and then we can open for questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. We had originally had some concerns about the breadth of the authority under this provision because we represent clients who file a lot of motions in the debtor-creditor area that don't really require any time of the court. And I want to thank Chief Justice Domenus and Kingsley for helping us work through those concerns, and they are fully addressed in the A6s, and they have actually taken out those kinds of motions that we were concerned about, such as default judgments, stipulated judgments, dismissals, and motions in arbitration, which are normally made to an arbitrator and not don't take any time with the court. So with the A6s, I just want to say we're fine, and again, thank them for helping us through that process.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Kingsley, what is the projected revenue? Do we have those figures yet? And it says, I think the last sentence, that allows the funds to be used for judicial department operations. What does that all include?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the estimates are approximately $5 million on the motions and $5 million on the collections, so a total of approximately $10 million. The operations are the circuit court and administrative operations. It's a general provision 1005. The arrangements have been worked out with the present speaker and majority Senate leader is to address our technology issues that we're desperately trying to fund improvements in, as you've heard.
Any further questions? Yeah. Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Plink, so this is not the money for the study on the facilities. This money would not be able to be used for that study and start the upgrade of facilities.
Chair McPherson, Vice Chair Wisman, that was not the purpose of these particular monies. And that bill that raised money for the facility study is in Ways and Means and deals with some filing fee changes. And Mr. Markey was involved in that process as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, Matt and I have labored over the numbers and figured out how to do that, and we have amendments to 2331 down in the Ways and Means Committee, and have presented those to the co-chairs and the all of the members of that subcommittee. Whether or not that moves forward or not will be up to the co-chairs, but the money is there, and we figured out how to do it. So, but separate issue.
Thank you.
I would say that one of the reasons that our folks kind of went from being very concerned about this proposal of the Chief Justice's in this bill to advocating for it is that we recognize that this antiquated computer system of the Judicial Department just has to be upgraded. And it's in everybody's interest to have that done, and particularly our clients who file. I mean, if we can go to electronic filing down the road, it will be a great benefit to our clients and others who use that system. So we think it's important.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kingsley, was the revenue figure you gave us annually or for biennial?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, it's biennial.
Okay, thank you. And one follow-up.
Go
ahead. Is there anything other than the computer system that this can be used for? What else is in the operating?
Operating could be used for any general operations of the court. So it could be used to fund any parts of it. At a certain point, we would need to go in for an expenditure limitation, and at that time, you would make sure the designation would occur.
Follow-up.
Go ahead.
Can any of it be used for judicial salaries?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that would fall under a definition of operations. Right now, the salary issue was part of what the Chief Justice said that the added co-chair funds should be designated for. And so at this point in time,
are we currently 49 or 50 in the country for what our judges are paid?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I believe we're 51. I don't know if that's D.C. or Puerto Rico that makes us out.
Representative Krieger, did you have a question?
No, I did not.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. The question I have is on page 2 of the amendment, and it's lines 18 through 21, where it states very clearly that 50% of the fees will go to the state's general fund, and then 50% will stay with the Judicial Department.
Yes, Chair McPherson, Representative Comp. This was set up in order to not reduce any of the funding levels that were currently going to the general fund. So right now at the 25 and 50, that's going to the general fund. So the amounts were doubled to the 50 to 100 and making the second half go to the operating account. That way the revenue stream to the general fund as it currently exists wouldn't change.
Okay, so just a follow-up clarification. So then the $5 million you stated per biennium?
That's in addition to
the current.
Sorry, Chair McPherson, Representative Comp. The current revenue to the general fund is $7.5 million, and so we did a more conservative estimate for an additional amount.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, and just to the committee or a comment that if we want to see this increased revenue take care of the technology and computer system, I would highly recommend that we suggest to the Ways and Means for a budget note to state that so that whatever the discretion, I mean, if that's what we're voting on here, I'd like to see it be used for the computers versus, and I agree that we need higher salaries, but is it our job or not, I guess is a bigger question, to give some recommendation for how the money's spent.
Representative Comp raises a good question. That is, that there are some budgetary aspects to what the action that's being asked of us here in this bill, and obviously, what we're the policy choice is: should we be applying these fees? But it's without aside from knowing that half goes into the general fund and half into the judicial department operating account, we don't have any role in determining what the fee dollars go to. And it might be helpful for the committee to, and for me to know a little bit more about how this interacts with some of the budget decisions that the Ways and Means Committee has been wrestling with, such as judicial salaries and other services that were curtailed within the judicial department when the cutbacks were made several years ago, and which under the co-chair's budget were to be restored. Do you have any background on that to share?
Chair McPherson, the judicial department budget has not yet been passed out. We did provide, at the request of the Legislative Fiscal Office, the Chief Justice's priorities for the additional co-chair amounts, and that was to address a shortfall in interpreters and also to address the judicial compensation issue. And then that left the unmet other needs to be the technology, some more critical workload issues, including the drug court. And that was money for which these sorts of funds could be allocated. Right now, this just raises revenue, so the other revenue-raising bills haven't gone down, but in order to spend money that would come in under this funding vehicle, we would have to get authorization for an expenditure limit, and then at that time, I'm sure the remaining discussion would happen, because we're still, as you know, a little bit in a state of flux.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to comment to the committee that because we're in work session, I think Representative Comp has brought up a good point, but this is a difficult situation in our budget process, and that this is a separate branch of government that we're okay in their budget for. And I remember last session we discussed that in the Ways and Means. So I feel comfortable without the budget note, because we're, you know, this is a branch, equal branch of government, and so to dictate how they're using that, I think I would be in favor. I don't think I'd be in favor in this situation. On other agencies, I might feel different, but. Since you are treating an equal branch of government.
Just a follow-up.
Representative Bonamici.
And I hope I'm interpreting Representative Comp's comments, but it seems to me that this is the reason it's split 50-50 is because the money's currently going into the general fund, so now they're anticipating a doubling, and half of that goes to the judicial, and we don't want to see the general fund affected. I think your concern is to make sure that there's enough to do what they need to do with that 50%. Should there be some indication or some message to Ways and Means that if this isn't enough to do what they need to do, then we should find extra in the general fund? Is that...
If I could follow up, Chair, because that is exactly what I'm thinking. But the other bigger, broader question, it isn't just for this committee, but how does policy intersect or connect with the budgeting process? Because it seems like we're on Venus and they're on Mars. But
we do have a member of the Ways and Means Public Safety.
That too.
Oh, good. Well, then we're covered.
And I have a note. Mr. Nelson, did you have some comments you wanted to offer up in our work session?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Judges Association. Just to elaborate on what Ms. Kingsley has said, we have been part of a large discussion about incorporating this bill, judicial salaries, as well as the needs of the judicial department in terms of the technology, drug courts, et cetera, and as members of the Ways and Means Committee who are here are quite aware. And those discussions have included the speaker, the co-chairs, as well as the president and the majority leader. So this is part of that package, and I can guarantee you that technology is at the top of the list to be addressed with additional funds. The judicial salaries have been allocated for within the budget right now. Those discussions are ongoing between the co-chairs and the leadership.
And for anybody on the panel who can confirm this, it's my impression that all of the revenue being generated, both the 50% into the general fund and the 50% into the judicial department operating account, could be used for any of these judicial department needs, that is, for salaries for judges, for interpreters within the courts, for a technology upgrade, for a full range of matters, because the general fund supports judicial department operations just as the judicial department operating account does. Am I correct in that?
Chair McPherson, you are correct if they allocate the general fund to the judicial department.
But it's available the purview for those of the Ways and Means Committee to decide whether to do that and to what extent. Representative Krieger.
Regarding the Chief Justice, I have the greatest confidence in what he's going to do. And we had some concerns about lack of drug court funding and the effect that it might have on the work that we did in the meth package. And I know that he'll do his best to make sure that those things happen. So I'm glad we got to the where we are, and I appreciate Mr. Marquis working with the Chief Justice and getting it taken care of.
Okay, are there any further questions for anybody here we have presenting in the work session? If not, then we have the A6 amendments before us, which are a consensus set of amendments and supersede the prior ones we have in our bill files.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -6 into Senate Bill 279.
Representative Krieger moves the -6 amendments into Senate Bill 279. Any discussion? Any objection? And the -6 amendments are in the bill.
Does SEP go to Ways and Means?
There's not a subsequent to Ways and Means on it. We could request that one be put on, but it has not had any subsequent put on it before.
Okay. Yeah, we'll move it out.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill, Senate Bill 279 as amended with the -6 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 279 as amended by the -6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative
Trump. Aye.
Representative
Cleaver. Aye.
Representative
Reed. Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wilson. Aye.
Chair McPherson. Aye. Senate Bill 279 is amended by the -6 as moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. And Representative Krieger, will you carry? Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 279. Okay, so we should go to it next. We're going to stand at ease for a moment while Senator Przanski comes for Senate Bill 347, which we'll go to next because of a scheduling issue for him. Actually, I didn't open the work session. Either did I open it? I'll do it just in case. Open a work session on Senate Bill 347A. So, Council?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 347A relates to discovery information in Dewey prosecutions in Oregon. In Dewey prosecutions, the state often relies on evidence that's gleaned from certain test instruments that measure the amount of alcohol within a person's breath
and then extrapolate from that the amount of alcohol that's in a person's blood, otherwise referred to as blood alcohol content, or BAC. Oregon recently switched to machines known as the Intoxilizer 8000, which replaced the previous Intoxilizer 5000. Blood and urine are typically extracted and analyzed through different processes and mechanisms. In Dewey prosecutions, defense attorneys often request, as part of the discovery process, that the state turn over any and all information relating to the particular instrument that was used to test a particular defendant's BAC. Such information can and does include the crime lab's maintenance records for the machine and showing how the machine has functioned in the past. Senate Bill 347A clarifies that certain information relating to these test instruments is not discoverable or admissible. Specifically, this information includes what it specifically includes was changed in the Dash 3 Amendment. And the Dash 3 Amendment is what should be before the committee's consideration today. This Dash 3 Amendment specifically states what discovery prosecutors must provide in Dewey prosecutions, which at a minimum is officer reports, test result reports, intoxilizer operator checklists, and what's known as implied consent form. The amendment defines discovery that a prosecutor need not provide as, quote, schematics, source codes, or instrument software that is not in the state's actual possession, close quote. The amendment also provides that a Dewey prosecution cannot be dismissed based solely on the unavailability of a private witness served with a subpoena for trial. So, for example, a defense subpoenas an employee of the manufacturer of a particular device, and that person being from out of state isn't available, the Dewey prosecution isn't going to be dismissed solely for that reason.
Senator Brzozinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Lloyd Brzozinski, State Senator, District 4. Council has read into the record what the A3s will do. I am asking the committee to adopt the A3s. I do believe that it does, in fact, address the issues that I brought forward through the original filing of SB 347. Specifically, if you remember the testimony, there are it has occurred in other states, one of them being Florida, where defense attorneys were basically requesting information that the prosecutor had no authority, possession of, or authority to get, and such as the schematics, the software, or the source codes for these machines. These are proprietary instruments, and because of that, the companies are not going to give up their proprietary information or trade secrets, etc., for those machines. And they were actually, the defense were being successful in some states of actually being able to have the case dismissed because their position was that if we can't have this information come before us, how can we make certain that our client is, one, guilty or receives a fair trial? Florida has actually reversed its position, and they've now adopted legislation similar to what's before you as to putting limitations as to what is available for these cases. No one is here, and specifically myself as a prosecutor, trying to limit the defense from being able to get the information they need to prepare for the case. But clearly, when you start asking for proprietary information of the equipment that's used, you're going beyond as to what's really the facts are before the court. And so this matter, the Dash A3s, I believe, really lays it out in very succinct terms as to what the obligations are for prosecutors, the government, and what they have to prepare, provide as a minimum. And all of this stuff is listed on page 2 of the amendment that's in bold print from lines 9 through 22. Sets forth exactly what those are. This does not limit the prosecution from providing additional information. The reason it's written the way it currently is there's one other area that is required by case law to be submitted to the individual or their attorney, and that's known as the certification of the machine is working correctly. The case law says that you have to provide the one that's within 90 days prior to the test. Some offices will, in fact, still do what has been traditionally over many years past, was to give the certification for the machine before and after. We want to make sure that that flexibility is still there. That is why you see it written in a way of saying minimally these four areas need to be provided, but it does not exclude an office from giving additional information.
And I believe the other two parts that council has gone over, page 4 sets forth specifically the issue that has been raised in other states. And then lastly, where you have someone that's been subpoenaed to come in to give testimony regarding the equipment that's used to test breath, blood, or urine, that in itself is not going to be, let's say, cause for the court to dismiss the case outright.
Any questions for Senator Przonski? And I don't see Ann Christian in the room. Ms. Alconish, did you want to say anything about the work on this bill? Okay, come forward.
Thank you. Amy Alconich here on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. And Ms. Christian just wanted me to say that Senator Przonski was incredibly open to working on this bill with us. She spent a long time working on some of the amendments. She's very amenable to making changes that we found to be helpful. We still oppose the bill, but think it's, which Senator Przonski knows, but we think it's much, much better in terms of the defense bar. So we thank you for your time. We thank Senator Przonski for his time and energy on this bill and for working with us so closely.
And Ms. Alconich, that opposition is just on the general principle that it should be the fullest access to information that might be helpful in the defense of a criminal defendant?
Absolutely. And some of the information, for instance, the source codes or how they test the accuracy of the intoxilizer. And initially when the intoxilizer 8000 was introduced in Tennessee, how they were able to find some of the flaws in the intoxilizer unit itself was having somebody who understands algorithms, which I don't, test those, and they were able to find out that it wasn't accurately working, and the company improved it based on some of those findings by defense attorney investigators. And one of our main concerns is that, in addition to the confrontation of witnesses issue, is that there will always be improved technology. We hope that the defense bar be able to access that information to make sure it's working accurately to protect the rights of defendants in DUI cases.
Okay. Any questions for either?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Alconich, if this bill passes, what will you do to assure the accuracy of things like the intoxilizer?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that's a good question. I don't really know. I think they'll be able to still access the manuals. They'll be able to access some of the information. And one of the things we worked on that does make this bill a lot better is that defense attorneys, I think, will just look to other sources in the prosecution to get that information. I don't know if it will be accessible through other sources or not, but that would be my guess of how we would approach a case like this. I don't know that there will be another machine for 10 years or 20 years or however long it takes for them to move from the 5,000 to the 8,000 to whatever the 10,000. I don't know what the next version will be. But I'm assuming that it will occur at some point, a better, stronger, faster machine, and I don't know how we'll get that information.
Mr. Chair, if I could maybe follow up on that. I guess there's a couple of things, Representative. The defense will always be able to go out on their own and find additional information or whatever they may want to. The type of testing you're talking about, when they bring these out, they usually are, quote-unquote, taken into a test market for that purpose. Oregon, as far as I know, has never been one of those test markets. In my years of prosecution, this is the third generation of equipment. 4011 was the first that I was familiar with in the late 80s, the 5000, and now we've got the 8000. And this is a much different system. Actually does a double take testing of the breath as compared to a single. There's still the certification that's required by law today to make certain the machine is up and running. It's all done by computer now, electronically, and it's tested at a central testing location, I believe, either here in Salem or in Portland, and they can test every machine because it's online. And the machine won't even operate if it's not properly working. It shuts down. And in many cases, you see where the law enforcement agency actually has to transport the individual from wherever they were attempting to do the test because the machine's not working to another location. Regarding that first front-end stage, I would say that there's enough checks and balances in place to make certain that those things are worked out. And I would assume that Tennessee was a testing area, and they brought it in specifically to make certain that it was working in the field as it was supposed to based on the lab work.
Council Stanford.
This is sort of a question comment both towards Senator Przanski in your role as a prosecutor more and Ms. Alconichson as well. My personal experience based on prosecuting Dewey's, the experts, the people who can testify about whether the machine was working or not and what maintenance is done on it or not, are state employees. And basically the company produces the machine, the intoxilizer company, gives it to Oregon, and then Oregon maintains it, works it, makes sure that does the certifications, et cetera. So to the extent that there are ever any challenges to how a machine is working, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's a state employee that you're talking about. And so nothing in this bill has any impact on getting that information. And if a machine was offline for a while, that will be in the certification. And you will know it and be able to challenge it. And the algorithmic challenges is something that that you would be free to raise right now about the intoxilizer 8000. And whatever the state has, if the state has the schematic source codes or software, the defense is getting it, is my understanding of how this bill has worked out.
May I respond? Chair McPherson, members of the committee, and I think those are two really distinct issues. One is, you have a machine that we know at this point, intoxilizer 8000, has the bugs worked out. The source codes are not really an issue for this particular machine, and defense attorneys do challenge the maintenance. They do challenge the some of the things with the I haven't done these kind of cases in a long time. They do bring experts in and talk about the machine. They talk about the fallibility of it. They talk about if it's been offline and all those things. And I don't believe that this bill affects those kind of challenges. But what I do think is that it's creating legislation that has an impact down the line when you have a field of sometimes swift and sometimes not so swift changing technology. And to tell a defense attorney you can't have access to that information when the next generation comes and the next generation comes is concerning. And that's where the algorithmic issue comes in, the source codes, and the things that are considered trade secrets.
Mr. Chair, just following up, if you look on page 4 of the amendment, lines 15 through 18, at the conclusion, it basically says, as counsel has said, that's not in the actual possession or control of the state. What we're trying to do is make certain that you can't have a defense attorney say, well, I'm going to subpoena this stuff out of Florida, and if they don't get it here, guess what? Your case is sunk because you didn't provide us what we wanted. That's what we're trying to get at. If it's in their possession, they're going to get it. And what we're just trying to make certain that we don't have the creativeness that we saw in other parts of the country impacting our cases here. And again, you know, my job as a prosecutor is to make certain that you get as much information before the jury as possible, and we have the duty, the burden, to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We're not trying to take away their ability to defend, but we're wanting to make sure is that we don't have these little loopholes of really putting the state in a position where it can never accommodate the discovery request.
Any further questions? Representative Cohn.
Chair, I just have a comment. Is this our last DUI bill that we're going to be seeing in this session?
I think in this committee, there's several we passed out to Ways and Means that we hope to see on the floor yet.
Right. Well, I just wanted to commend Council Stanford. He's brought us through Dewey's, Pooey's, Pooey's, and at least he didn't say Suey.
Actually, that's tomorrow.
I can always come back, Mr. Chair, and do my Razorback call again.
We would be honored. Committee, we are in work session. We have the -3 amendments before us here on Senate Bill 347.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3s into Senate Bill 347.
Representative Barker moves the -3 amendments into Senate Bill 347. Any discussion? Any objection? Then the -3 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 347 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 347 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended by the A3 amendments. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Barney.
Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
President Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Chairman Perkin?
Aye. Senate Bill 347, as amended by the Acre Amendments, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, would you have that?
Thank you very much.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 347 and open a work session on Senate Bill 406.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 406A is the Humane Special Agent Bill. It's the bill that would clarify that the governor has the authority to commission and decommission special agents to enforce the animal welfare laws. There are amendments before the committee, the dash A3s. Is that correct? And I will let Chair Likes, Mr. Kulich, come up and summarize the changes to the engrossed version of the bill.
Mr. Kulich.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Kulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. What you have in front of you with the dash threes is essentially a complete gut and stuff of the original bill. What we tried to do was, after the last hearing, we sort of listened to all the concerns that were brought up and tried to address every one of them and come back to you with the dash three. So I'll briefly just sort of touch base on some of the changes that were made to the bill and some of the additions that were made to the bill. Section one is primarily exactly what Senate Bill 406 is before you right now, the A and gross. The only changes that we made to that were we did add fighting animals and theft of animals to the animal welfare law edition up on line five. And the other change that was made, was suggested to us, was on page 2, line 11, instead of the Humane Agency may enter into a contract, it was the Humane Agency must enter into a contract. So that's primarily the minor changes with the Section 1. Section 2 and 3 are the larger changes. They're the ones that, you know, really addressed, I think, a lot of the concerns that were brought up at the hearing. One of the biggest concerns that we heard was would this replace sort of local law enforcement, or would this infringe upon their rights and their jurisdiction? And so we said, no, that wasn't our intention. We only have four officers statewide that work on this. So we specifically said, certainly Section 2 Section 1 says that basically we will work cooperatively with law enforcement, that we basically, if they call us, we'll come out and help. We defer to their authority and, what they want. We sort of take their direction. We're not there to replace them. And finally, the issue with sort of the local law enforcement was making sure, if we are executing a search warrant, that they have oversight and that, we ask them and they consent before we execute a search warrant. So we tried to address that concern. The second one was accountability. What if something happens? How do you do a complaint process? And so sort of the Section 3, Section 2-3 was basically to say, that if any allegation goes to a law enforcement agent, that it is reported to the governor's office and that local law enforcement can investigate, they can take necessary steps, but certainly they can also send that report to the governor's office, making sure that they're aware of any abuse of authority. And I think the final issue that we addressed in this new bill this new amendment was Section 3. This was the DPSST training aspect. This language was pretty much taken from sort of the current language for other law enforcement in terms of what they're required to do. Certainly, Mr. Wells next to me can talk more about that, but it deals with, you know, hiring and you know, swearing an oath to the Constitution and stuff like that. So we think that the Dash 3 amendment, Senate Bill 406, is a good bill. We think the Dash 3 amendments make it a better bill. So that is the changes to the bill.
Are there questions of Mr. O'Coolidge or of the rest of the panel he has with him? Representative Krieger.
Last week, Mr. Chair, we got this information from, I can't remember who it all was here, but there's a whole bunch of stuff in here. But it shows the affidavit for a search warrant dated March 2nd of 07, Clackamas County. And who is Austin Wallace?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger. Austin Wallace is one of my investigators. He's a special agent with the Oregon Humane Society. I am his supervisor.
Have you ever seen this application for a warrant?
Yes, I have.
Look at the top. It says, I'm a special agent commissioned by the governor or as a peace officer, which he's not. Is that right?
My understanding is under our current commission with the governor, with our contract with the governor, we may act as peace officers. Yes.
Mr. Chair, if they've already had it, why are they asking for it again in the bill?
I think the as I understand it, and Mr. O'Coolidge can elaborate on this, is that this is already happening under an older statute that arose decades ago, maybe over a century ago, under a statute that is sufficiently broad in language, but which was for a different purpose. Related to railroads, I think, is the nature of the statute, and that what the purpose of this bill is to create clear authority for something that's already going on. And that's my understanding of the purpose. It's not there aren't going to be new people out doing something that they aren't already doing. It's to make it clear that they have authority to do what they're doing now.
I'll follow up.
Go ahead.
I had mentioned to you the other day about getting hold of Farm Bureau because there was some resistance for them because of their concern about the agency or your people getting involved more in commercial livestock type complaints that might appear to be abuse or whatever. Did you ever get a hold of them to try to get any wording massaged into this that would relieve their concern?
Representative Krieger, I did contact Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I had told her about the conversation you and I had, and she said that there's really no definition of commercial livestock, and that it's been a concept that they have played with in past sessions, but there isn't one that works. I suggested, can we do sort of like a, you know, put a number of like 500 head of cattle or, you know, something like that. Would that work? And she said, no, that wouldn't work for us either. So she said she was going to look at sort of what they've done in the past, see if there was anything workable, and try to get back to me if she did find something. I'm assuming since she didn't contact me again that there is not a workable definition to do that, but it was a conversation I did have.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm looking at the letter to Dear Gene here. And number two, it says this bill simply replaces one that expires after being in place for 100 years. And I tried to get to that question the other day. I don't understand if we don't take action on this bill. I don't understand that something bad happens.
And it's a follow-up to your comment, too, Mr. Chair, that you were making about the statute that they've been operating under and how this is to clarify that they have authority. I think this is not only clarifies that they have authority, but also spells out exactly how they will operate, what they need to do, how they will qualify. So even though there is a broad old statute that they're operating under, and I don't know, they can probably continue to operate under that, I think it's better to have the guidelines and the sidebars that are in this, that were in the bill that are now in the amendment.
I just want to be clear. Is there anything that's expiring after 100 years?
No, I think that's not, it's not accurate to say. I mean, it's a statute that continues in existence. It's just not a very good fit with what the actions that are being taken under that authority now.
Chair McPherson, I did find, Mark handed this to me. It's ORS 131.805 is the current statute which allows the governor to employ special agents. And right now the governor is commissioning humane special agents for two-year periods. So in terms of the expiration, it's not the 100-year statute that is expiring. It's the two-year commissioning which expires in October, I believe. November 1st. Ms. Harmon may be able to talk a little bit more about the history of when it started. I do believe this was originated from the governor's legal counsel, who said this is kind of an old statute that we have been using to commission your agents. It would be better to have something a little clearer. And so that's kind of what originated the bill.
Representative McPherson, I'm Sharon Harmon, Oregon Humane Society. To Representative Bonamici's point, that the old statute is so vague, and it's the one that allows the governor to deputize anyone for any purpose. This bill before you, Senate Bill 406, with the proposed amendments, the A3 amendments, really defines the role, limits the authority, puts in the standards for training, the credentials. It's what we have been doing, but it's spelled out so that everyone's clear about it. There's no expansion, no jobs are being lost, no money's being spent. It just is a much better public policy through this statute than the current one, which is very vague.
Representative Barker.
That was kind of what I was going to just say. The other day after the meeting, I talked about some concerns, and these concerns, I think they really did meet it by really restricting by delineating, but they really say what they can and can't do. May execute a search warrant only with the oversight, prior consent of law enforcement agency. So I think this is a good bill. It really does clearly define the job, and where before somebody could have really run amok with the broad discretion, and this really tightens that up. I think the amendments will make this make the law better for everybody, all concerned.
Because we have gotten stuff amendments here, is there anyone else who came today to attend the work session would like to present on this? Let's excuse this panel then and hear
a couple.
You want to put this question to this panel here?
Yes, please.
I'm sorry. Just hold off a moment, Mary, and then we'll get to...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. The contract, there is not a contract being used now is when the governor commissions you or whatever. Is that correct?
Representative McPherson, Vice Chair Wisnett, there is a contract with the governor's office, and it is largely the A3 amendments. How curious, we've come all the way back full circle around to putting into statute what's in the contract.
Do you have, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Do you have statute or rules to implement the old, is there any statute, the statute we have here, is that as broad as it gets? Does not get in the detail of what's going to be in the contract or any of this stuff in the statutes?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Wisnett, that the current statute essentially says, I just hand it to Representative Cameron, that the governor has authority to appoint special agents, and that's pretty much it. And I think it was enacted to deal with railroad
employees. So who would be in charge of writing the statutes to implement this bill?
I believe it's something that would have to be agreed upon with the governor and the representatives of the Humane Society, as long as it includes these provisions that are within the bill. So
it would. Farm Bureau could be involved in writing those?
Conceivably, they could be. I mean, it would be up to the governor, really. The governor has the authority to commission or not commission. If the governor's not happy with the contract, if the right people aren't involved, the governor...
But I'm talking about writing, because I've sat on a couple of work groups that are working, so who's going to be given the authority to implement the bill that we passed?
It would be the governor. The governor would have the ultimate say. The governor would have to comply with the terms of the statute that says what must be in the statute, in the contract.
He could put together a team.
He could. He or she could.
Any further questions for this panel? Good. Thank you very much.
I do have one more question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Since we're trying to codify this in statute, and there was a discussion about who we are accountable to, was there any thought given into actually having the Humane Agency be commissioned by the local sheriff's department and serve instead of at the will of the governor, at the will of the sheriffs?
Representative McPherson, Representative Cameron, that has been brought up a number of times. The Sheriff's Association opposes that action.
Okay.
Just one other, if I may. Since you're private, I'm assuming the employees are not under PERS, or they are, or are they?
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, our employees are only entitled to the benefits provided at the will of the Oregon Humane Society. They're not entitled to PERS. This doesn't broaden there's no money from the state in any way, shape, or form to fund these investigators. We're simply asking for the authority to do what we've always done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnick.
I think you've worked and you're good on this stuff and trying to be sure people are responsible and all that. The question that Representative Barker brought up is, I think we could still, in the rules that we write to implement this bill if it passes, I would like to see the local, in other words, the governor can commission you and be the overall, but he can delegate, you know, your operation or whatever to the local police department, county sheriff, whatever, even state police, he could delegate that. The problem is the state police, the county sheriffs, they don't want the liability of you guys, let's face it, right? So when we start writing, if this passes, the implementation could still be the governor has the liability, the overall responsibility, but the operation and the daily supervision of you doing your thing could be put under whoever you're assigned for that case or whatever, but the local law enforcement. And I think hopefully that would reassure some of the concerns of the Farm Bureau and the citizens or something like that are concerned about who you're operating under. So that's why I'm concerned about writing the rules. I think that there's other issues of command and control and things like that. Because, you know, we've seen cases, and the Dear Gene letter is another example. I've had a lot of cases in my district that have gotten great press about how these people are going out and helping in situations. But you come right down to it, and it appears to me the bottom line here is they're doing a service that's helping some of our communities, but no one wants the responsibility or liability of using this expertise. And so I really think the key to this bill, if it passes, is that the rules that we're going to write could assure and make it a better operation if we write those rules in detail like that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Council? Senator
Bonamici. I don't see there's rulemaking authority in this bill, and I think rulemaking comes with an agency bill, and I don't see that. I do see in the amendment, however, that the Humane Special Agent works cooperatively with law enforcement agencies, and if there's an allegation that the Humane Special Agent has abused the agent's authority, that can be investigated by law enforcement agency or by the governor. I don't know if there's rulemaking.
But I might just offer an observation. The structure is a contract between that's part of in connection with the commission, and so while it wouldn't be formal, maybe rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act, it does strike me that that's the process by which further refinements of the scope of authority.
That's my concern. We have it in statutes, but it's very broad and very general. So that's where the details of how the contract will say and how you operate the command and control and things like that could be put into place.
Representative Krueger?
On page 4, Mr. Chair, at the top, lines 1 through 7, the Department upon facts obtained affidavit, da 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 da. Of this section, within 12 months of employment, if the department finds there is good cause for such fare, the department may extend up to 1 year the period that a person may serve as a humane special agent without meeting those standards. So it's up to a year plus a year. It would appear then that you could have police powers for 2 years without having met the standards. Is that what it says?
Representative McPherson, Representative Krieger, this is standard language that came from LC with regards to the DPST process for certification. It wasn't anything that we put in. It was what is standard. It is what the current protocol is for law enforcement now.
Do you know, Counselor, what the standards are for a police agency to get someone certified before they can act as a police officer?
Representative Krieger, I don't know what the standards are. But your reading is correct, though. That's how I read it also.
Representative McPherson, Representative Krieger, it is our organizational policy that these officers are not commissioned through us until they have completed their training. They're not able to act as law enforcement until that training is completed. That's organizational policy. We take it to the next level.
Go ahead, Representative Wisnick.
I think it's important here because do we know what the governor's office or the governor, how he feels on this? Is he ready to continue to be the liability?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, we have had numerous conversations with the governor. Certainly we have talked about doing this piece of legislation. They have also indicated if the bill doesn't pass, they will continue to commission the agents.
And I can add that I've also spoken with the governor's office and let them know. I haven't sent them these particular amendments, though most of this was in earlier drafts I think they have seen. And so they're aware of it, and they're not here, obviously, but they do know that this bill is being considered.
If those are all the questions of this panel, then thank you very much. Mary Botkin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees. We represent roughly 250 animal control officers who work for the sheriff's departments around the state of Oregon. And we continue to oppose the bill. We think that this is, that the draft, these amendments make it better, but certainly not okay. Let me just state very emphatically, and clearly, for the record, that as long as there is a bill that establishes a private, non-profit, not answerable to any elected official police department, giving non-profit employees the right to arrest, detain, or otherwise overlay police powers on citizens without being responsive to local law enforcement, we will continue to oppose the bill. We do not think law enforcement duties should be contracted out to the lowest bidder or to a nonprofit who is not answerable to elected officials on a regular basis or, more importantly, the citizens. We do not believe that a governmental agency or the legislature can successfully say that suddenly we're giving all of our liability to this nonprofit group over here and we're not going to be liable anymore. And oh, by the way, just pick up a little insurance to cover any costs. We don't think that works. It didn't work when we contracted with private prisons in Texas. It won't work now. And this will be a great program as long as there's no problems. Now, having said all that, let me be clear. We do not have a philosophical problem with the Oregon Humane Society. We utilize their services. We work with them all the time. The difference is our officers work for the sheriff. The sheriff employs them, the sheriff is responsible for them, and the sheriff accepts the liability for their actions. And by virtue of saying to the Humane Society, we want your assistance, they also extend their liability to cover those officers who are working for the Humane Society while they're working for us. or working with us. Finally, let me just sort of say that I've done a little legislative history search myself. We've not been doing Oregon Humane Society folks for 100 years. The first time I can see that we utilized Oregon Humane Society employees was during the Kitzhaber administration, and I don't know exactly why we did, but the first time the governor utilized the authority of this statute to give animal control functions to an outside agency was during the infamous Mustang roundup in Eastern Oregon, when the wild Mustangs were starving to death in Eastern Oregon, and the governor empowered ranchers and some other individuals in Eastern Oregon to assist in the roundup of those animals so that they could be fed. And they did that so that if there were damage, if there was damage done, or if there were problems, that the ranchers and property owners would be covered under the state's tort liability. And that's the first time we can find that that was utilized. Not saying that it's the first time, it's the first time I can find it. I think there's probably not any way to make this bill okay for us as long as you create a private police department. And that's just the reality. So, you know, we'll see them on the floor if that's the case. I'd encourage you not to do this, but...
Representative Cameron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, thanks for your testimony. On page 3, section 2, humane investigation agencies shall work cooperatively with law enforcement agencies.
We do that now.
Section in the next paragraph, humane special agent shall defer to the direction of the law enforcement agency. So they are, I mean, when I read this, though, it says that they have to defer to the sheriff or whoever it is that's in charge, who is the public employee at the time.
I don't know. I don't have any practical experience in how this works under this language. So I don't... I'm not being argumentative. I just don't know.
Follow up, if I may. So the testimony that we received prior was this is basically the contract that they operate under now with the governor's office, and LC's put it in a form of obviously this proposed amendment. So it does say they must yield, or I don't know if it says must yield, but it says defer to the direction of a law enforcement agency if a law enforcement agency is investigating. So it sounds like they do have to submit to the public officers.
So if that is accurate, Mr. Chair, does that mean, I mean, I really want this on the record. So I'm very clear, and the record's very clear. Say Sheriff Harkle Road down in Lane County says, you know what, I don't want you in my county. They can't come? If they get a call that says there's, 200 starving bunnies down here, they can't come?
That's how I read Section 2, Sub 2, page 3.
So if Bernie Giusto says, I don't want you in Multnomah County, the Oregon Humane Society out on Marine Drive cannot usurp his authority, right? I need to be very clear, and I think it's only fair to the Oregon Humane Society and to our organization that they don't have the authority to do anything in Multnomah County unless Bernie says it's okay, but more importantly, if he says it's not okay, they can't.
One thing I will add, thank you, Chair. In Section 2A, it says, a humane special agent shall defer the direction of a law enforcement agency if the law enforcement agency is investigating a violation of animal welfare laws in the law enforcement agent's geographic jurisdiction. So, yes, they are required to defer. However, that's qualified by this if the law enforcement agency is investigating a violation. Now, that doesn't mean that a sheriff could then open up an investigation, which I think the Humane Society would be happy with. But I just want to point out there is that qualification. That doesn't take away from what's in Section 2.1, which says humane investigation agencies shall work cooperatively with law enforcement agencies. And there's further language that states the law enforcement agency requests assistance, then the humane investigation agency shall provide that assistance. It's not clear to me what the effect of that is. It certainly is a statement of policy that this is how they're supposed to undertake their enforcement powers. But I think you really have to read those two sections together, the 1 and the 2A, to see how they work.
Krieger, that was the exact point I was looking at. If the law enforcement agency is investigating, well, if they're not, and they are the original responders to a bunny farm in Lakeview, and the sheriff isn't investigating it, they don't have to talk to him at all. They can just go there and do it, unless the sheriff somehow finds out and says, hey, wait a minute. Maybe that, then, of course, I would assume they're going to defer or they're going to at least work with them. But there's no requirement on them to get permission in a particular county to do it if the sheriff hadn't made the original investigation.
I mean, one thing I'd like to also point out, though, is if you look at 2B, it states a humane investigation agency may execute a search warrant only with the oversight and prior consent of the law enforcement agency on the primary jurisdiction. And that's a pretty big qualification. So if there was a problem going on in a bunny farm or whatever it's called, they couldn't. There's really not much you can do without a search warrant to get onto that property. I guess there's exceptions to the search warrant requirement that could apply. But that is a pretty strong statement that they have to work cooperatively. They would not be allowed to execute search warrants unless they do so with the consent of the local law enforcement agency. So.
Okay, and that would also hold true for OHSU's research labs, which are regularly harassed. Our scientists are harassed at home for, quote, cruelty complaints.
Was that a question to me?
Yeah. If there's
a search warrant, then...
Do they have the right to access our research labs through OHSU then?
If they're investigating a crime that falls within the statutes that are listed, which are all the animal welfare statutes, and they need a search warrant, they absolutely would have to get the consent of the local law enforcement agency. And then there's also is this other language about them having to work cooperatively with law enforcement agencies. So I do believe if you read all these together that it would be perilous for them to act without going through the law enforcement agency, because I'm not sure it would stick, anything that they discovered, if you look at these together. And it's a little unclear, but certainly 2AB is not unclear at all. They have to have the consent if they want to execute a search warrant. And the same is true of 2A. They have to defer to the direction of the law enforcement agency if there's an investigation ongoing already. So those are clear. The only part I'm not certain of the effect of is the shall work cooperatively part. What happens if they don't work cooperatively? I'm not certain about that. But the other parts are crystal clear to me, at least.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to counsel. In regard to 2A and B that you were just discussing, and the search warrant provision, which is B, does that not also have to tie to 2A, that they shall defer to the direction of the law enforcement agency if the law enforcement agency is undertaking an investigation of violation of animal welfare laws? And then, so those have to be conjunctive as well, one dependent upon the other.
I would say yes and no. I don't think if a law enforcement agency does not have an investigation ongoing,
they still could
2B would
warrant.
Still apply. They still would need the consent of law enforcement to get a search warrant. So even if a local law enforcement agency says, I'm just going to ignore what's going on in that, that bunny farm, if they want a search warrant, they're going to still have to go through local law enforcement. That's the way I read it.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, do all counties have animal control officers, and what are their responsibilities as far as investigating abuse of animals?
They are responsible under the law to enforce animal cruelty laws. Cruelty, abuse, and neglect are under their authority.
Mr. Chair, I really feel we need to have Joe O'Leary or someone here to answer from the governor's office. I mean, I want to...
We've met with the governor's office, too, so it's frustrating.
Well, I think it's clear that the governor's office would like to see this authority clarified. They would prefer not to continue acting under the old statute. So it's clear
but
that
they... Do they see this as a duplication? Do they see this as aiding and helping counties? Yeah. You know, we've got a representative here saying it's duplication.
Mr. Chair, just thinking that in the conversations we've had on the floor of the House, when the ONC money goes and the sheriff's laying off people, I don't think he's going to fire all his road deputies and say, I think I'll keep the animal control guy around. I'm concerned about that. And this is ongoing. I mean, what we're doing is codifying what they're already doing. And we haven't seen the problems. And I think we can sure keep an eye on that.
And one thing, if I could just add, is that it's discretionary. So even if a new administration comes in and decides they have philosophical problems with these types of officers, they don't have to commission anybody. So this is not requiring the governor to do anything. So I just want to point that out so the committee is aware.
Another comment about Ms. Bodkin representing the animal control officers. But we can tell from the correspondence, for example, that you received, and even from Ms. Botkin's comment in the earlier public hearing where she said, we need all the help we can get, they need help. They don't have enough to do what they need to do, and that's where these people come in from the Humane Society for free.
Committee, if there are no further questions for this panel, let's excuse them. Or I'm Representative Flores.
Well, I'm sorry, but we heard from Ms. Bodkin, but we did not hear.
Well, I just wasn't sure whether you did. You want to present?
Thank you, Chair McPherson. My name is Terry Witt. I represent Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Our major concern is the extension of the authorities into areas that I would call quasi animal humane areas. Things like nuisance. Animal trapping, fur bearing trapping, predator control, reintroduction of the wolf, cougar, and bear hunting. These kind of activities, which historically, not Oregon Humane Society, but the Humane Society of the U.S. has been very, very actively involved on an advocacy basis. And our concern is that gray area, that we could see some impact of certain special interest groups to carry out these laws in very different ways than perhaps what the legislature had intended. And that includes things like animal husbandry and dairies. And I think you're well aware of bills like pig confinement and things of that nature that are being claimed as being inhumane treatment. So we are very concerned about the broadening of these special interest agendas through a quasi-police power type of agency that has no responsibility to report back to any elected official. And that's still, I think, as Ms. Bakken talked about, that is, from our perspective, one of the biggest problems with this bill is that there is no responsibility other than the Animal Welfare Agency's Board of Directors, which none of which, to my knowledge, are typically elected officials. So I think there's some real accountability needs. Not that we don't debate the need for humane special agents. We think, you know, they do perform a valuable role, but I don't think we can just, what some people would call the PETA police. We don't need a whole bunch of PETA police running around the state impacting things based upon their will.
Committee, we've got 3 minutes before we have to be on the floor, and we've spent a lot of time on this bill both before another day and then discussing it today. I'd rather not have it come back to us again tomorrow. So unless there's something we really need to hear from this panel, I'd like to excuse them and be able to get on with our business here. We have the Dash 3 amendments before us on Senate Bill 406. Do I hear a motion?
I'll move the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 406.
Representative Bonamici moves the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 406. Any discussion?
Just the only thing I would want to say is the U.S. Humane Society is an office in New York, has no shelters, It's a political thing. It has nothing to do at all with the Oregon Humane Society. And I understand the concerns of food and shelter, but they're really a separate, totally separate thing.
Right. Plus, we didn't hear any evidence or testimony about any of the current humane officers doing anything that you mentioned as a potential concern.
We'll keep an eye on that.
I'll put on the record again, Mr. Chair, that I might think that they provided a service in my district that I know about, and I will look into the animal control situation in my district to be sure what's happening, why they're not involved. But I think the key here, and I would, I'll write the letter to the governor to be sure that the Farm Bureau and other people are involved in writing the implementation of this bill so that we address the concerns of those people.
Yeah.
Representative Krieger.
My concern is pretty much where Mary was, that there's no city, county, state accountability to any elected official. And so you're taking a nonprofit, and that could be any nonprofit, Kiwanis, Rotary, and giving them some authority as police officers over a section of government. And if we need four more animal control agents underneath the sheriff's office, then that's how we ought to be funding them. So I won't be supporting the bill.
Mr. Chair, I have some concerns as well, and I frankly, it's one of those things where sometimes you find an unnatural alliance, but I have some concerns about some of the questions that have been raised just in this committee today, and I did review the prior committee hearing from which I was absent, and I'll give reluctant support to the bill. Here, I may not on the floor.
Will there be opposition to the amendments, or should we? We'll have a roll call on the bill, for, of course, what is required. But is there objection to the amendments? I know there will be to the bill. Is there any further discussion of the motion to move the A3 amendments? Any objection to the A3 amendments? When the A3 amendments are in the bill. Any discussion, or do I hear a motion on the bill?
Move Senate Bill 406 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 406 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair
Wilson? Aye. Senate Bill 406A, as amended by the A3 amendments, moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Bonamici, would you be willing to carry that bill?
I will, thank you.
Very good. That concludes close the work session on Senate Bill 406. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can complete today. For the record, we will be rolling over until tomorrow the work sessions on Senate Bill 573A, Senate Bill 629A, Senate Bill 1042A, and Senate Bill 248A. With that, our meeting is adjourned.